I want to introduce you, Rick and Beverly Ross. You got to meet Rick during worship, and boy, what a great job. As he mentioned, as I mentioned earlier, Rick and I worked together at the Mesquite Church of Christ. Back 88 to 93 was when we were there, and they came in that last year we were there. And their kids, he's mentioned earlier also, all of them were involved in ministry in some way. Jenny was involved in children's ministry, and Jonathan's an incredible worship leader, and Josh himself has written books, and I'm sure you have a case of books, I think, with you. If you would like, I would encourage you to take a look at that book that Josh wrote recently, and maybe they'll tell you a little bit about it. But I would encourage you to take a look at it. They definitely have a family testimony that is incredible in the things that have been written and said. And so I'm grateful that you guys are here, and I want to give you as much time as we can to talk. Beverly, Rick talked a little bit about Jenny. Let us give you an opportunity to kind of share from a mom's perspective. Tell us a little bit about Jenny from your perspective.
I could probably take the whole 45 minutes doing that. My best friend loved so hard. I love the way she loved. She was a sold-out believer and constantly encouraging not only children but their families in faith, and was such an example to her own husband and taught my granddaughter well. Malaya only had Jenny, her mom, for 9 years, but Malaya's faith has very deep roots because of things Jenny poured into her and taught her and had her memorize. And Jenny's handwriting is still in scripture all over their home. They didn't take off any of index cards hanging, chalkboards hanging with Jenny's handwriting. It's a little, you know, some of the chalk is a little gone, but they will not erase her verses that she poured into Malaya. So a sold-out believer to the Lord, strong disciple, and loved her family, including her extended family, well. Well.
Now talk a little bit about what you do. A lot of what you do now kind of extended out of this situation, even though you'd kind of plan to go in that direction. Talk a little bit about what you do right now.
I was a first grade teacher for 12. I was a stay-at-home mom for 12 years, taught first grade for 12 years. While I was teaching school, I was with a district that required you to have a grad degree, a master's degree. I got it in marriage and family, never planning on leaving the classroom, but wanting to help mommies and daddies with children. I got tired of, and this feeds in with this question, I really got tired of getting down on the floor beside little children, whether it was during days of the school year or particularly the last day of school, and saying, it's going to be okay. And they knew I was lying, and I knew I was lying, because some of our children were not going home to okay. And so I wanted to help moms and dads, so I became a therapist. I do counseling and do a lot of marriage and a lot of relationship family. But since February of 2010, it took me months to get back in the counseling room, really to protect my clients, because so many of them I wanted to say, are you kidding me? You're calling that a problem? And so, you know, I just laid out for a while, but now I do a lot of grief. I do marriage and family and a lot of grief counseling. It blesses me to hold space with other people walking the same road, and I do a lot of grief. So
we'll be doing a grief seminar tomorrow night.
I will be doing a grief seminar tomorrow night, and I was telling Jack I'm going to teach it. It'll be an hour and a half, but it will be uploaded, and I will get Jack the information, how you can listen to that or watch that. It's going to be hope through the holidays, specifically for November and December. One thing I do want to say with that, though, I do counseling on a sliding scale. And so I think that is one of the things that separates us out from other counseling centers. We want
to... Rather than adding more grief patients to your load...
Yes.
How did this situation change you as a counselor? You know, how did this kind of... Did it change you?
Great. Totally changed me. Yes, yes, yes. It freed me. Oh, I've never been asked that before. I love that question. It freed me to know there are no right answers. It freed me to know that what we do best as people is offer connection and hope, and we offer that no one journeys alone. But it freed me to have to feel the pressure of the moment of being with someone and know, I've got to know how to fix them. I've got to pull on all the theories. They've got to leave here today with a fix. And now I know what I offer are tools. Right. Tools and tools for the journey, and offer a word of hope that is more meaningful. I feel like so much of maybe, I don't know, what I did before was fluff, and now I feel like I operate in a different depth.
Now, Rick, what about as a minister? Same kind of question. How did this situation change you and how you minister to people?
I think it's made me more vulnerable in my preaching.
Mm-hmm.
I was raised in a generation, Phil, I just saw come in. Maybe you can relate to this too, Phil, but in our training, we were nearly told, don't ever talk about yourself. And we wonder why so many churches then, you know, we talk about this plastic version of ourselves that we often bring to church. Well, when your preacher's been encouraged to pretend like he's something he's not, then what's to be expected? And it's made me much more vulnerable. I'm much more transparent now. I see a greater urgency about the message today. And I think I see what I do more as inviting people to live out this incredible story of God.
Mm-hmm.
Very good, thank you. Now let's get real specific. That's where one of the things I wanted to do in this particular session was get to the basics of dealing with things. How do you find peace in a situation over which you have no control? How does that happen?
Let me start.
No, go ahead.
You know, I am an avid reader. I read all the time. The entire time Jenny was in the hospital, and up until about 8 weeks after death, I could not absorb one word that I read. About 8 weeks out, I was going to try to read through the book of Job. Now, I say this with the greatest of respect, I've always liked the book of Job. It hasn't ever been someplace that I've camped before. It wasn't ever my favorite. I got to the end of Job 3, and in this particular version I was reading from, it says something like this. The greatest of my fears has come true. What I've dreaded most has happened. There is no peace for me. There is no rest. Peace has been destroyed because death has invaded life. And I was reading, it was a big book, and I closed the book, and I sat on my back porch, and I was just like, that's it, Lord. That is exactly right. This is the first time in my whole life I've had no peace now. That's going on 12 weeks or so. No peace. And I'm like, I know that's not right. I know that's not right. And I felt this settling in my soul. Some people asked me if it was a male voice. It was not a male voice, but there was a definite settling in my soul that the Lord spoke into me and said, my daughter, that is Job speaking from his place of pain. You as a baptized believer have the Holy Spirit inside of you. And where my spirit is, there is peace. And so from that day forward, I pray already multiple times this morning that the Lord will open the eyes of my heart, that I will not miss one glimpse of his peace. Now, I'll tell you, I've not had a whole day full of peace since, but I haven't had a peaceless day since. But there are moments that I practice breathing him in, literally with my physical breath. I typically do this because Jenny was trached at the end. But I typically do it like this. God, I just want to breathe in peace. I want to breathe in peace. And it's settling. So it's totally unexplainable, but I do believe it is a gifting of the Spirit that we have to get out of his way to allow him to express that within us.
Good. Rick, how would you answer? How do you find peace?
I think this episode in our lives caused me to realize how much I needed peace.
Mm-hmm.
I probably just was living assuming that I was at peace when I really wasn't. But there is such a desperation
for that in my life. Now, there's three words. There's three words that kind of guide my life right now, and peace is one of them. Man, I pray for God's shalom over my church and over me just constantly. Peace and hope, those are huge words. So I don't know. I guess that would be my answer to that.
Okay.
Just living out a no matter what kind of faith. Before you can have peace, you've got to come to really trust. You've got to say, I am going to, no matter what, I'm going to choose to trust God.
Now, a lot of times we go through the same thing where we blame God. Mm-hmm. How do you keep from blaming God in a situation like you guys were in or others, you know, that are in similar situations? How do you not blame God for this?
You and I talked about this some last night, and I certainly think there's space for people to go through a period of time where they're angry with God. I think God's big enough to handle that. Just like if our kids were angry with us, we wouldn't want them to stay there, but we allow that for a period of time. But I can't say I've been angry with God through this whole thing. We've been extremely disappointed with God. Because we really thought, I mean, Mighty to Save was our theme song from the time Jenny went in the hospital, and we thought we were just going to have this grand story that we could tell, you know, about how God's delivered her, and look how God's worked in her life, and the life of her doctors and nurses, and we didn't get that story. So we were disappointed with God. My theology just does not take me personally to a place of blaming or getting mad at God. I have been angry, but my anger has been at Satan because I think Satan's the one who, through the fall and the after events, has caused the pain and suffering that we experience. So when we sang this morning about no tears in heaven, we sang a song that, man, no tears, no death, no pain, no suffering. Bring it on, Lord.
I had to wrestle with that because I knew, I'm not even sure if I can say this without crying, I knew if he would just wiggle one eyelash, she would be saved. I knew that it, with any movement or breath in the room. And so what I did wrestle with a lot of disappointment. I wrestled with almost, say this with respect, it's so hard. I wrestled with almost being embarrassed and being like I needed to rescue God, because Jenny was 31, and so there was a lot of young people. ACU was very involved, a lot of young people, and I didn't want people to walk away from faith because of our family. And so I went into that a bit, but I finally had to come to the conclusion that I was whipped. I did not have any energy left, and I'm a pretty energetic girl, and I couldn't blame and worship. And worship was familiar to me. And worship was the path I chose to take. And I couldn't do both. And so I chose that path. I had to surround myself with that path. And I still make conscious choices of, I choose you, Jesus. I choose you, Jesus. I choose to believe that this story is truth. I choose to walk with you. I choose to believe that somewhere in Israel, there is an empty tomb. I choose to lean into that, and I just didn't have enough energy to blame and lean into that.
Now, you mentioned reminders like Mighty to Save. In fact, one of the most powerful experiences I've had as a minister was going to Jenny's funeral and seeing her parents in worship to God, praising God, singing Mighty to Save. To this day, I still have trouble seeing that. Because I experienced that with you guys, and in my thoughts, I'm still thinking God was mighty to save, and He didn't, you know, and so.
But He did.
But He did. That's right. That's right. and so those reminder type things. How do you deal with daily reminders of Jenny? You know, that you go through that. You mentioned it takes 6 months just to reach the height of grief. You know, and the rest of your days living, you will always have that. So what are some things, advice you would give people on dealing with the daily reminders?
I think everybody's different, so you have to work within who you are. Beverly and David surrounded themselves with pictures of Jenny, with things she had written. Early on, when grief was raw, I just wasn't ready for that. Now I embrace it. When I see something that reminds me of her, it's a more of a sweet than bitter moment. Okay, it's bittersweet, but it's more sweet now than bitter. I don't want to forget anything about her. And I guess there's a fear, a little bit of a fear in me that I might. You know, we're 6 years down the road now, and I can still hear her voice. What I mean by that is if I replay something of hers and she's saying something, you know, like something that happened, it's her voice. I can still hear it. So that's good, and that's comforting. But I think everybody's different and has to deal with that in their own way.
I mean, like this morning as we sang that song, I loved Susan reached over and took my hand, and I knew that your heart was with us. And so for me, there's a connection in knowing that other people stand with us. Wednesday night, we're eating at a Mexican food restaurant in Decatur, Texas. My granddaughter had come out to go to church with us, and she looked up and said, "That woman knew my mommy." And, I mean, a woman had just moved to Decatur from the Fort Worth area, and I could not sit there one more moment. I mean, I went over to the table, and I said, "I want to meet you. I'm Jenny Biz's mom." And she's like, "Oh, I loved your..." And she looked at me and said, "It was such an honor to know her." And so any connection like that, I love. I made the decision the first year on Jenny's birthday that I absolutely do not want, and I still make this decision, I don't lean into this easily, that I do not want the pain of her death to overshadow the joy of her birth. Even if she were going to be born, and if I knew that she was going to die when she was 31, I would still pick to have 31 years with her. Mm-hmm. And that means I would choose to walk this road, which I can just hardly even, that doesn't even roll off my tongue very well. But I want to celebrate memories. I want to laugh. And we talk about her all the time, still on her birthday. We have family tradition on birthdays. We go around the table and everybody tells their favorite thing about the birthday person. Some of our in-laws have to really get used to that when they join our family. But we do that, and we still do hers. We all go out to eat on her birthday, and we go around the table, and most of our little guys were too little to remember her, but now they've heard enough stories. They have something that they can remember that they've been taught about her. So we love it.
It means a lot to... Is Josh... I don't remember his last name that led singing this morning.
Josh Sneed.
Josh, are you here?
He may not.
He came up to me this morning and said that his wife had been Jenny's big sister in club. And just those, you know, just those connections, I mean, it just kind of brings a moment of joy into your life, you know?
Yeah.
Don't be afraid. Hopefully all of you know this already. But when you know someone that's grieving, don't be afraid to mention the person's name that has died. They want you to talk about that person. They want to hear what you have to say. It's not going to hurt them. It's a blessing to them. So I want to encourage you to do that.
Do y'all have any particular mementos of Jenny that you keep and kind of hold on to that are special to you? You know, that... give you that sense of her still being there?
I do. I have a few. And I guess I'm just going to talk about the ones that are just really, that I'm using right now. But for years, for graduation gifts, just new babies, just baptisms, etc., I have given an index card binder with Sharpies. I taught first grade. I color code all my scriptures. And I've always given that. And I'm like, write verses in there and allow those verses to be verses that you want to chew on, etc. I did not know until Jenny died that Jenny gave index card binders too. I gave empty index card binders. Jenny did not. Because Jenny walked a road of pain and suffering herself. Jenny struggled with secondary infertility. And so much of what I've learned about how to suffer, I learned at the feet of my daughter, of not getting her way. And so Jenny gave index card binders full. And one of her friends that she had given an index card binder with took it to a copy, Office Max, whatever, and had index card binders made for us in Jenny's handwriting. And I keep mine by the side of the bed because they're verses about how to sustain faith when the way gets dark.
And that's healthy, right?
Oh, it's so healthy. Yeah.
A lot of people think you have to just get rid of everything.
Oh, no. Yeah.
But this is a healthy thing. Yes. Now, Rick, what about you?
She got me this wallet for Christmas. And normally by now, it's starting to fray and everything. Normally by now, I would have replaced this wallet. But I think about it a lot when I see it. It's a reminder to me. I can't think of really anything else I have like that.
Now, you started to say this a while ago, but, you know, people want to be helpful. You know, and you mentioned how helpful it is to say their name and to not be afraid to go up to people. What are some things that are helpful to people going through grief that maybe would be helpful for us as people to be able to help them better just to try to help them through? What are some things that were helpful to you guys going through this?
You want to go first?
Mm-hmm. I'll be glad to. One of the things that I found helpful, Mike Cope called us between death and funeral. And, you know, Mike and Diane buried a little girl. She was 10 when she died. And Mike said, there's a couple things you need to know. Don't ever change your bio. You will always have 3 children. And I love that. And then he said this. People are going to say some really stupid things, but they're giving you the best they've got. Cover them with grace and mercy. And so you will not find me speaking much about the stupid things people say, because I'm really afraid if I do, they'll stop talking to me. And my healing, my joy, the way the Lord has blessed me is through relationships. And so I would rather people talk to me. And so now I'm not really sure what this means exactly. I've journaled it. I'm trying to figure it out. But whenever I talk about grace and mercy, I do this. Not sure if it's a waterfall. One of my friends saw me do that a lot, and she got me an umbrella, a clear umbrella. And so to me, grace and mercy, just, I know you've given me the best you've got. I love that. Sometimes I will correct if it hurts me. Like, God needed another angel in his choir, and I'm like, no, God needs nothing. God is God. God did not need Jenny. You know, God is God. And I don't want Malaya to hear that, because I don't want her to think that God thought he needed her mommy more than she did, because she believes, and so do I, that Malaya really, really needed her mommy. Now, God is redeeming her pain. God is supplying. But, just being with one example that I give, 2 of our elders' wives, one, no matter what was happening, she would wait for me after church on Sunday morning. She would just stand around alone, and she would wait for me, and I knew what she was waiting for, and I got where I predicted it, because she would come up to me every Sunday and say, what can I pray for you this week? And it helped me to name a prayer request, and I loved her faithfulness in doing that she would wait with me. Another elder's wife, if I would have been there this morning, she greets me at the door every Sunday morning, and she whispers in my ear, the tomb is empty, every Sunday morning. I know she's going to do it. The tomb is empty. She sits by us during church, and sometimes during the Lord's Supper, she will lean over and say, he is risen. The important thing you need to know about her is she has buried her only child, her daughter. And so it reminds us both as she pours.
Now, you mentioned Malaya. Talk a little bit. Beverly and Malaya spoke at the Christian Schools convention deal last year. Mm-hmm. Can you talk just a little bit about that? And then I want Rick to answer that original question.
You know, that girl just, she's 15 now. She's getting ready to drive. And she's had some really hard times and some dark days. But before this conference, she was going to come to Abilene with me. She loves being here, because we tell her lots of mommy and daddy stories about being here. I said, Malaya, would you want to speak with me at this conference? And she said, yeah, I do. And I was like, whoa. I said, okay, now, listen, if you're going to speak with me, you're going to have to be ready to practice it before you get, because I wanted to know what she was going to say. And she just did this fabulous job. I mean, she did about 10 minutes and talked about what it was like. You know, I remember what I was wearing when I found out this was my mommy. I wanted to talk about my mommy all the time. She was in 4th grade, but I didn't want to talk about her death. But I wanted to talk about her, and then I hated it that my friends quit talking about her. Jenny was a permanent sub at her school. And then she said, when it was over, I'm like, Malaya, how'd you learn to do that? And she said, I've been watching people. And I thought that was so cool, because I do believe the Lord is going to redeem her pain in that. She sees things from a totally different perspective than other 15-year-old
She was amazing. I was able to be there that day, and she looked way older than what she actually was,
she really does.
Maturity-wise and stuff. Yeah. Now, Rick, what have you found most helpful?
This is a side note, but Beverly was talking about, kind of referred to the story I shared at the end of my sermon about when I said the tomb is empty. Some of you follow some of these major authors, and Scott McKnight, who is one of the more well-known theologians right now in our world, is actually going to use that story in his next book.
So it's out.
Was pretty cool. I saw an article just Friday on Facebook that John Mark Hicks from Lipscomb University had written some stuff on what to say during grief. And I don't want to, because Beverly's right, I don't want to discourage people from, I hope nothing I say keeps you from talking to people. But he suggests that when we talk to someone who's in grief, use I language. Now, I know we're taught not to do that most of the time, but use I language. I'm thinking about you. I'm going to walk with you. I'm going to be praying for you. And when you start using you language, that becomes interpretive then. You're trying to, you need to do this or you need to do that. They probably, especially in raw grief, people don't need to hear that. There was an example I saw on this same post where someone had lost their six-month-old baby to SIDS, and someone had said to them, well, at least now you won't have to potty train them. Oh, my goodness.
Or you could just have another one.
Yeah, you can just have another one, which is true.
Yeah,
that's a true statement, but it's not helpful to a person that's in raw grief.
So can you think of anything in particular that has been said to you personally that was really helpful at the time, like Beverly mentioned?
I don't think words stick in my ears as much as people's presence, and maybe even just more the compassion in their eyes and things like that. I can't put my finger on any specific words.
Yeah. Okay.
I really believe in presence ministry.
Yeah.
When someone's in raw grief, there was a guy at our church that not long after I'd moved there, his dad committed suicide, and I was over there just within minutes after it had happened, and I bet we sat side by side for 2 hours. And really nothing was said.
Yeah.
But I still feel like I ministered to him in that situation.
Yeah.
And if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned using I statements, which is a great way that's a very helpful thing. What are some other things that are good to say to people that are in grief? What are things that would help us as we're dealing with people in pain? What are some other good things to say that would be, you know, helpful?
Well, of course, to meet needs. I mean, grieving people cannot. I've worked with several, and this wasn't me at the beginning, but I worked with several that couldn't even remember how to cook. It just sort of freezes your brain. Your brain becomes like a sponge. So, of course, you know, when my dad died, we looked out the window, and there was another minister in town mowing our yard. You know, just doing things. But I also think reminders of the Lord's presence. What I usually will speak is something from Ephesians 1 that is my favorite, that I'm praying that the Lord is giving you exactly what you need to walk this journey. And I want to be encouraging that the Lord sees and that He knows, but that pain is real. Because I think frequently in church space, we've denied people the ability to feel pain, and they think there's something wrong with them when they feel it. But there's something powerful about, I mean, grieving is a natural, it's the way God wired us. He wired us to experience
pain.
Tell
them about the tears of grief.
Oh, I love that. One of the things from counseling research that I know is that the tears of grief contain a totally different biology than any other tears. They contain stress hormones. They contain toxins. And without being shed, grievers can become very ill, physically and emotionally. The tears of grief need to be shed. We need to provide places. Other cultures grieve very loud and with a lot of tears, and it's accepted. One of my own I mean, as a counselor, I'm in counseling all the time. It's just usually over chips and salsa or Olive Garden breadsticks. It's just usually at a meal. And one of my own grief therapists told me over a meal, strength is way overrated. You need to give it up. And that so helped me to know I don't have to try to put on a strong face. For my children, for my grandchildren, or for my people, I can show up where I am and what I'm experiencing. Did that answer the question? I don't remember the original. Tears.
Well, I got you off on the tears thing, but this is good.
So one of the things that I think you guys have really impressed upon me is we don't have to say anything.
That's right.
We feel like we have to.
Yeah.
But
it was a relief for me to find that out because I always wanted to have the right words. And let me tell you, in raw grief, there are no right words. There's just not.
Pressure off.
That's right.
The pressure is off. Just be there.
Yeah.
And the better thing is just to be the presence.
Yes.
Just be there sitting next and not feel like you have to say anything.
I mean, again, go back to the story of Job. That ought to be a beautiful example to us. When they open their mouths to start trying to explain, that's when the whole thing blew up.
Yeah.
When they just sat with him, that was the best ministry they provided for him.
Well, we just got a few minutes left, but I wanted to get to this question for sure. How do you celebrate who Jeannie was when you're in the midst of hurt and pain? You know, how do you kind of break through that barrier sometimes that you feel like there's so much pain and so much anger or anguish, or, you know, we go over the stages of grief and all that kind of stuff, but, you know, how do you celebrate their life when you're in the middle of all that?
Which, by the way, Beverly could deal with that, too. Kubler-Ross, I can't remember what her first name is, that came up with those stages of grief. She never intended that to be a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 step. I mean, that's the way people have taken it. We move through those stages of grief, but it's more like this. I mean, you know, it's not just a smooth path. What was your question again?
Celebrate.
How do you celebrate through all that?
Just a few weeks ago, we had Jenny's Run for Hope. It's a part of the Greg Pearson Foundation. Greg Pearson was a student at ACU that had died of cancer a number of years ago, and his family started this foundation to help people while they're in the hospital. It pays their car notes and things like that. And so they helped David, our son-in-law, when Jenny was in the hospital. And as we have now begun this thing that's under Greg Pearson's foundation that raises money too. And it's so gratifying because it grows every year. I mean, I was afraid the opposite would happen. I was afraid as we get further from the event, people would begin to forget her. It was pouring rain this whole time last time, and they had the biggest event they've ever had. And we still have people coming up to us at things like that saying, I had walked away from the Lord, but when I saw Jenny's funeral or when I heard about her, when I read Facebook care pages through all that, I turned back to the Lord, and I'm walking with Him now. Those are things to celebrate. Those are weird serendipities that came out of a very bad situation. Which, by the way, I want to make sure I get this in. There's a book I would recommend to any of you that are grieving. It's written by a guy named Jerry Sitzer. It's called A Grace Disguised. This is a guy that's a professor at a seminary in Washington State, I think. And his wife and mother and child were killed in a tragic car wreck one night that he was in the car too, with two infant kids. So he's grieving this loss on the side of the road, having to take care of his kids at the same time. And so he wrote this great book. I mean, it really is a good book on grief. And there's a line in there that I hold on to so often. He's looking over his whole life and he says, you know, this was a real bad chapter in a really good book. And man, I'm getting to the point where I can really relate to that. My life is still good. Bad chapter in it? Oh, absolutely. But it's still a good book.
Yeah. Doesn't define your life.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, in some ways it does.
Well, yeah, that's true. Beverly, how do you celebrate through the pain and the grief that was there?
Well, one of the things that I've learned is that joy and grief can hold hands in the journey. And I used to think maybe those were in opposition, but now in my life, they're woven in the same fabric. Brene Brown is an author that I follow. She's a social worker at the University of Houston, and I'm absolutely crazy about her work. I mean, I just love it. And she says that joy, which is what I think of with celebration, she says that joy is the most foreboding of all emotions. That we are very skeptical to experience joy because we're waiting for the other shoe to drop. And I believe, again, like I said with peace, I know that you believe that joy is from the Spirit, and I don't want to deny anything in me that's from the Spirit. And so I choose to lean in. I may cry, but now my celebrations can hold tears. Yeah. And I want to choose the road of celebration about her and about her life and about other things too. Because frequently people say, are you afraid one of your other children are going to die now? Because it's a reality for you. And I've made the choice that I'm not going to be afraid of that. And I pray that I won't be afraid of that, that so I can enjoy celebration moments. But also, you'll notice the theme in my grief journey and probably the journey of my life is in relationships with other people. And right after Jenny died, Brady Bryce called and wanted me to speak at Summit that year because the college students had been so involved with us. And I agreed to do that, and Marianna Long came. And she's a friend of mine for not as many years as our friendship is deep because we have experienced some things side by side together. But Marianna came, and she walked me through celebration without words at the end because Jonathan, our son, was there when I spoke that day, and he led us in some worship at the end. And I was wiped at the end of this. I mean, it's 6 months after death. I was so exhausted at the end of that. And I went and stood with Marianna when it was over. Or Marianna came to stand with me when it was over. And she just reached down and picked up my hands while Jonathan was singing and held it. And sometimes when I'm walking this road and I'm like, I don't know if I have energy today to celebrate. I picture Marianna just coming, or even Jesus, as I felt like Jesus prodded her to do that, just grabbing me and saying, come on, my daughter, we're going to celebrate today. We've got life. And picturing him putting spiritual braces on my knees every morning just to get up, to get about life.
Good. Now, Rick, you mentioned a lot of books. Talk a little about Josh's real quick. But I know he'd want us to mention that. And you actually do have some with you if people would like
them.
Yeah,
I'll run and get them as soon as we're dismissed. I'll be back in here in 2 minutes.
Just real quickly, talk about his book.
Well, it's a book called Scarred Faith that he wrote. Josh is, he's working on his third book now, but this was his first book and it was well received. Basically, he chronicles our journey in the early part of the book. He tells more in-depth account of our story, and then he ties that in with some ministry things that have come out of that. Some decisions he and Casey have made in Memphis to move inner city, for instance, came out of all of this. And I think, of course, he's my son, but I think it's a really good book. It's an easy read, and I think you would get a lot out of it.
Yeah, you want to say anything?
You want to add?
Of course.
Beverly's always at a loss for words, but
yeah. It was on the top 100 on Amazon for about 3 months from social justice and grief. It is well read even outside of our tribe, even outside the Churches of Christ. It has Q&A in the back of it, and so a lot of churches are doing it as Bible studies, small groups, ladies' classes are doing it. One of the things that I want to encourage you to get it or to get a grief book about and read with a friend or so is I believe that we prepare while we're walking in the light for what we will do when darkness comes. Mm-hmm. And I think what this book does is it gives us a language to bear grief, a language to begin the process of experiencing suffering and pain. I remember early I was with Josh and I said, Josh, so many things are pointing that God has prepared our family to suffer. And he sat back in his chair and he said, Mom, I believe that God prepares all of his children to walk a road of pain and suffering. So much of the Bible deals with, what do? What do we do when the lights go out? And I believe that reading a book like this, whether you're in grief or whether you're walking total light, will bless you and help you to have phrasing to use about it.
Yeah. Okay, you've got 1 minute each. What's the most important thing people need to know about grief and grieving?
Go ahead if you got something.
Okay, most important thing is that I believe you need to make a decision. I believe I need to make the decision that no matter what happens, I'm not going to walk away from faith. No matter what happens. And I believe you need to make that decision while you're walking in light. I remember Jenny struggling with secondary. Tell me when my minute's up. Jenny walking the journey of secondary infertility. This is the phrase that my boys did their sister's funeral. The boys and Rick Ashley, but Jonathan opened her funeral and told the story. Our family had decided that we were all going to go on a fast because Jenny's heart was so broken over the secondary infertility. And we did not tell Jenny and David that we were going to fast. And before her death, she called a family meeting several years before her death and said, "Mom, do you remember when I was a little girl and you taught me to plan my funeral?" And I did do that. I had no idea I'd be present for it, but I did teach my children to plan their funerals. And what that meant was to pick two or three characteristics they wanted to be known for, that they wanted spoken at their funerals, and live into those characteristics. And Jenny said, "I don't want people to ever walk by my casket and say, 'Oh, there's that poor infertile woman.'" But she said, "I want people to walk by my casket someday and say, 'There's a woman who continued to serve and praise the Lord when she didn't get her way. And now I am that woman.'" And I believe that some of you could be walking that road too. Because I do not believe that death is the only grief producer. Maybe not even the worst grief producer. But I believe we have to make a decision to develop, as Rick called, a no matter what kind of faith. Is my minute up or do I have time left? Okay.
This may not be the most important thing, but it's the most important thing I haven't said yet that I want to share as we're wrapping up. Okay. For the first several months after Jenny, maybe the first year and a half after she died, I was really, really struggling with prayer. I was really struggling with what I had believed God to be. I was bordering on deism because we had had 13,000 people praying for her to be healed, and she wasn't.
Explain what deism is.
What?
Explain what deism is.
Deism is this kind of belief that God set everything into motion and then He retired. So He's not involved in our world anymore. And I was just on the verge of believing that. And Lynn Anderson called me one day. He's one of my mentors in life. And he called me. And this was in the middle of when Lynn was going through his cancer and everything. He was in bad shape. But it was like he just had all day for me. And I told him that. I said, "Lynn, I'm just borderline deist right now." And this is the freedom we need to allow people when they are in the depths of grief, is allow them to search and stuff. Don't be alarmed that they're not, you know, toeing the line right now. Just be with them. Because Lynn said, he said, "You know, Rick, when you're in the midst of grief and pain, probably isn't the best time to be making theological decisions." And man, that was just the perfect answer I needed right then.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to share that.
Yeah. Good. Thank you. Well, let me say a prayer over you guys. Great. Thank y'all so much.
Our blessing.
Y'all be sure and thank them whenever we finish here. Let me say a prayer of closing and a prayer of thanks for them being here. And also, let me remind you, if every single person would grab a sack and take it to the NPR, it would only take one trip. So if you would, please, after this prayer, please help us take all this stuff to the NPR. Let's pray together. Father, we are so thankful for Rick and Beverly, for their lives, for Jenny's life, and for this whole experience. Lord, it's hard, it's difficult, but we know that you're there. Mm-hmm. We know that you are there at all times and that you're walking with us, as Rick has said in his lesson today, that you're always there with us. And so, Father, help us to see you. We pray that you will guide us through these situations in life that are hard, especially losing a loved one. And Father, just give us a touch of comfort and a touch of healing at a time where healing may not be available. Father, just be with us as we close out today. Help us to reach out to those who are grieving and to do what we can to just be a presence to them. Thank you for your Son. It's in His name we pray. Amen.
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 You are dismissed.